File 1641, Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Madam Chair and members, Senate File 1641 is a late bill, so I appreciate your time and your indulgence and your attention to the matter. Madam Chair and members, as you probably know, Senate File 1641 would permit the medicinal use of cannabis.
Before you begin, Senator Dibble, I just wanted to clarify that we generally stick to areas that are in our jurisdiction, so you can give us a kind of a brief overview, and then we'll want to – I understand you have some amendments, and then we'll want to just focus mostly, and we'd like the testimony. Also, we are taking testimony to try to focus mostly on just the sections that are in our jurisdiction. That is sections 4, 9, and 20, mostly to do with rulemaking and impact on local government. All right. Thank you, Senator Dibble. Sorry to interrupt you.
Not at all. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Just very, very briefly, by way of 60 or even 120,000-foot overview, this bill would allow seriously ill patients to use medical cannabis under very tightly prescribed circumstances and conditions in conjunction with prescription from their doctor. And those conditions are spelled out very specifically. It allows a limited number of places in the state, again, under very tight circumstances, and we can get into some of that detail in the rulemaking section. So a very small number of places where folks can obtain and the conditions under which medical cannabis is produced, controlled, tested. It creates a regimen for some advice and some consultation and some study on this idea and imposes a number of safeguards, both in terms of diversion and public safety, and make sure that, again, we're construing this whole idea as narrowly as possible. And on the reverse, making sure that in those instances where there are violations, sanctions are pretty steep and pretty serious. With that, Madam Chair, I do have the A11 amendment.
The A11 amendment has been passed out, I believe.
Mm-hmm. All right. So this is not an author's amendment per se, because this is not the original Committee of Original Jurisdiction, so I can step through it first.
Yes.
And then if the committee sees fit, someone can move it and we can adopt it. So the first change, Madam Chair, is found on page 4 of the first engrossment of the bill. That just simply so some of this amendment is a little bit outside of your jurisdiction. It's just some stuff that we picked up and cleaned up, either staff or occurred to us as a function of the last hearing. Not major substantive items. So if you're so willing to entertain
That's
some of those
fine.
Ideas, so this just simply kind of clarifies that when folks are using medical cannabis in smokable form, that it's not done in any public place and it conforms to the requirements of the freedom to breathe or clean indoor air requirements. Next, Madam Chair, you see on page 5, and referring to the amendment starting on line 1.6, the advisory committee, which you'll see later in the bill, has a title, the Medical Cannabis Advisory Council. Dropping to the bottom of page 5, we insert the words "and testing" on line 5.35 after the word "production." Requirements for the safe production and testing of cannabis. This is in the rules that the commissioner is authorized to create. Then, Madam Chair, we go to line 1.9 of the amendment, which brings you to page 6 of the bill. It's just an effective date, the day following enactment. And then fast forward to page 10 of the bill, which you can find on the amendment language on line 1.11. This is a cleanup item that was found by staff. It just inserts the language that the qualifying patient needs to notify the commissioner if their card that authorizes them to acquire medical cannabis has been lost or stolen. And then dropping down to just after line 30, and you can find the language on line 1.14. This simply moves the language that you see on the next page, lines 11.13 to 11.17. It kind of just takes that that paragraph and moves it over and places it after line 10.30. So that's just moving that language over. Again, a staff recommendation. Then on line 1.20 of the amendment, just a grammatical clarification that the patient has notified the commissioner or has been notified by the commissioner that their card is void in that circumstance that's described in that paragraph. And then, again, line 11.10 and 11.12, which you find on 24 and 25 of the amendment, like just talking about those instances, including those instances where cards have been stolen and notification needs to be made. Moving on to page 12 of the bill, which you find on lines 1.7 and 1.28 of the amendment. And this is an item that is within the jurisdiction of this committee. And these are those provisions that allow for zoning, siting, land use regulations by jurisdictions that have zoning authority. So we just create better clarity around that language. So the language would read, Madam Chair, in addition to other zoning regulations applicable within the jurisdiction, a county, home rule, charter, or statutory city or town may enact reasonable zoning regulations that limit the land use, limit the use of land for alternative treatment centers or safety compliance facilities to specified areas. Moving on to page 18, so we fast forward. Page 18. We just delete that word "and." It's just hanging out there. It shouldn't be there. Then jumping up to page 22. Again, this is the advisory council that I mentioned earlier. This amendment kind of takes in all of the good governance items as this committee likes to see, as developed by the committee that had been chaired by Ann Rest. We call them the Rest guidelines, and so we put it through the Rest treatment, the Senator Rest treatment, and buttoned up some of the
details.
We
just call them the guidelines.
Okay, we call them the guidelines. I have a fondness for calling them. Because she was always so fierce in enforcing them, so I'm scared to not conform. So I can walk through that very quickly. The name of the advisory council will be the Medical Cannabis Advisory Council. We delete subdivision 1 because those items are dealt with then later. The membership, again, it's the Medical Cannabis Advisory Council, calling it the MCAC, consists of the following 8 members. And so we delete some of the extraneous language there. 4 healthcare practitioners with experience in treating patients with debilitating medical conditions appointed by the commissioner, so we clarify that. A representative of patients with debilitating medical conditions appointed by the commissioner, clarify that. And then we name the additional 3, and of course, those folks wouldn't be appointed by the commissioner because they're, by definition, either the commissioner of public safety or their designee. And then we add to the duties a subdivision 1 or a paragraph 1, which reads on line 2.4 and 2.5, duty would be to make recommendations to the commissioner and the legislature on implementing sections 1.522 to 152.39. That's basically the bill, the proposal in front of you. We do the renumbering, of course. And then after line 27, and you can see all of these provisions on lines 2.12 to 2.20 or 2.21, some of the items that had been lacking in the guidelines. So the council shall be governed by Section 15.059, and that speaks to compensation, allows for some minimal level of compensation for the members who, of course, aren't employees of state government. It designates the commissioner of health or his or her designee as the chair and the person who convenes the meetings. Meetings are convened quarterly. A quorum is not required for action. A requirement reporting. So the council is accountable to the commissioner, consults with the commissioner on preparation of a report. This is a report that was added in the last committee by Senator Rosen amendment. And so this advisory council is responsible for the preparation of that report, and then allows for the commissioner to staff and provide administrative support to the council. Then, Madam Chair, we take the report that was added at the last stop and codify it, because that's going to become kind of an ongoing rolling requirement under the provisions of the bill, that there be kind of a biannual assessment of the research, the data, the experience of the state on implementing the provisions of this proposal. First report due next February, and then every 2 years thereafter. And we change just a little bit. We include some assessment of existing medical research and literature. We make sure that the experience of our own state is taken into consideration in the preparation of that report. And then, Madam Chair, you see Section 23 on the amendment, which is on line 3.11, and that drops in on page 23. The initial meeting of the advisory committee, the advisory council, the appointments to be made by July of this year, and the first meeting to be by August of this year, and then some provisions for paying for all of this through the fees that are generated that'll be assessed by the alternative to the alternative treatment centers, the testing facilities, as well as the cardholders. Madam Chair, that's the amendment. I can respond to questions.
Any
on the amendment.
Any questions on the amendment? Senator Scalzi.
Thank you, Ms. Chair, and I'm wondering why Section 23 isn't under our purview. Talking about the advisory council initial appointments, is there some reason? It would appear to me that that should come before this committee.
It is, Senator Scalzi. It's just because the amendment changes the section numbers, I didn't mention that earlier because we're adding that section.
And then, thank you, Ms. Chair. And then I had another question related to the assessment. It's identified by community representatives on line 2.25 of the amendment, and I'm not sure. Maybe I missed it, but I'm wondering if the term community representatives is defined somewhere else. Since this is the amendment, and it looks to me like new language, and I understand that may not be in our purview, but it still talks about the advisory council to address issues and concerns identified by community representatives. I'm just wondering who they are.
That came from the Rosen Amendment. Right, Senator Dibble.
Madam Chair, that's correct. Yeah, so that that is not new language per se. It's just we're taking this assessment, this study, codifying it, moving it to a different section. We didn't make a lot of changes to it. That was language as proposed. If you see Section 22, that's deleted, and then it's put into a new section and codified. That was language. You find it on 23.26 of the first engrossment. So the short answer to your question, Senator Scalzi, is no. Community representatives is not defined. I can't speak with great specificity to what Senator Rosen intended, other than I can guess that she wanted to be sure that this assessment, when the commissioner does this assessment, is taking advice in from a wider range of stakeholders.
Interested persons and stakeholders, right. Senator Peterson.
Madam Chair, I was going to move the A11 amendment.
I think we have some more questions on the A11, then we'll take your motion. Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On the front page of this amendment, it talks about if the registered qualified patient's registry identification card has been lost or stolen. And I'm just wondering, I know that's not under our preview, but just like when I get medication from or prescribed from a doctor, there is a deadline on that particular prescription that if I run out, I have to then come back to the see the doctor or get a mm-hmm. Is that, and I'm just wondering if because of lost or stolen, if there should be some kind of a guideline for that with the case of this being so prescriptive and wanting to be so tight that if someone loses a card, we're falling into a situation where it could be easily picked up by somebody else, and in a short amount of time, that person could take and use that and falsify that person's identity, so forth. And I don't know. It just kind of came to me that I know that when I get prescriptions, I have to have a deadline there. And I thought if we lose our card or we have to go back to the doctor to see them to say, yes, we do need that.
Senator Anderson, counsel points out that on page 10.7, there is an expiration subdivision 5 that all ID cards expire 1 year after the date of issue. Is that what you were looking for? 10.7, 10.8 on the bill.
Madam Chair.
Senator Hall.
If I can interject here, I had the same question. I guess if I can add to that, I think if it's lost, the commissioner should be notified maybe within 24 hours of that person realizing that it's lost so that we can stop the use of it or something like that. I don't think that refers to the section you were giving us, which was a time when it expired.
10.9 is lost registry ID cards, and it talks about cardholder shall promptly notify the commissioner and has more language there. Is that what you're looking for, Senator Hall?
It might be.
And then below under Section 7, there's a notification section.
So,
Ms. Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You answered my questions. I mean, you answered in the way I was going to respond. I'll also just point out that the registration cards are photo ID, so an individual's photo is on there. So we have the 10-day standard. Also, the registry cards would be turned off. You know, these are they have unique identifiers. Notification would go out to all of the alternative treatment centers a given registry card with a given identifier on it is no longer valid. Again, as we get into the rules, we can talk about some of the security and access measures that the commissioner is authorized to create to tighten up the regimen. We can be more specific if we want to be through amendment. If 10 days is not a strong enough standard, we can shorten that up.
Senator Hall.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Dibble, could you tell me on the advisory council how many total members there will be?
Senator Dibble.
Madam Chair, there will be 8.
Madam Chair?
Senator Dahl. I'm sorry, Senator Hall.
Senator Dibble, then, thank you, Madam Chair. Wouldn't it be a good idea to have an odd number for voting purposes, or am I wrong there?
Senator Dibble.
Madam Chair, well, I don't anticipate this is an advisory council. The commissioner would make use of, and I guess I hadn't thought about it. I hope that it's not a contentious and highly divisive body, but a more collaborative, consensus-driven body that's using evidence and research to make advice to the commissioner rather than trying to, you know, bind the commissioner with ironclad decisions. But
Madam Chair,
Senator Dibble,
I would agree with that. I just think that, there are times it doesn't have to be divisive just to say we don't agree with each other, but this is where the majority would be, so I would at least throw it out to you to consider that.
Thank you.
Senator Peterson moves the A11 amendment. Is there any more discussion on the amendment? All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Okay, Senator Dibble, why don't we go back to, unless members have questions, why don't we go back to Section 4, which is the rulemaking section of the bill, and go through that a little more carefully.
Great. So, Madam Chair, I can just walk through that quickly or slowly, whatever is the desire. So, Madam Chair, you see in Section 4 there are established 11 points on which the commissioners asked to make rules. And just generally speaking, I think this is where we see the proposal in front of us as meeting and exceeding, I think, the best practices that we've found in other states that have a medical cannabis program and are doing so successfully. The goal, of course, is free and fair access, but under a very limited basis, with no diversion, no use of any of this cannabis by anyone other than those individuals who are so authorized. That is the goal, and we invest a lot of authority in the commissioner to establish very, very strong guidance for the activities of the public, but especially the private sector in that. So,
why don't you walk us through it, Senator Dibble? I think we should take some time.
Okay, very good. We know, of course, that we've established the debilitating conditions for which folks can access medical cannabis, and if folks want to see that for themselves, that is back in the definitions section. I'll let you find that. But, of course, information and research evolve over time, and so rather than going back and changing the law, we thought we would allow the commissioner to add to the list of medical conditions or treatments to the list of debilitating conditions.
And are you
conditions.
We're just talking about Section 4 now, right?
Section 4, paragraph 1,
paragraph
starting
1.
On line 5.4. And so there's a rather than allowing the commissioner in their individual capacity, alone in their office, they are the commissioner's asked to request guidance from the Medical Cannabis Advisory Committee, notice to the public, creating a hearing process and an opportunity to comment.
So the point here is that although you list debilitating medical conditions, you give the commissioner the ability to identify more.
Correct. And we also give the public the ability to say, hey, we have an idea for a condition that should be added as well. So there's a petition. You can petition in and ask that something be added.
So I know that Senator Scalzi had mentioned to me that she thought that, is it fibromyalgia? That's not listed here, though, is it?
Ms. Chair, that would be listed under severe intractable pain as defined in the other section. So I think that's where that would fall. I had a concern about that, and I think the severe intractable pain maybe is more tightly defined, and maybe the author could comment on that, versus anyone who just has pain constantly and goes to the doctor, and I guess you would get pain medication, or you maybe could get this. But I don't know where the severe and intractable might be defined.
Madam Chair, severe and intractable pain does have a specific statutory definition, and that's why we use that, and we opted for severe and intractable versus chronic pain. Mm. Those were the two terms of art.
What does intractable mean?
I'm relieved. Madam Chair, members, I am Heather Ozzie, political director of Minnesotans for Compassionate Care. Intractable pain, the statutory definition requires this to be a pain condition that is not responding to conventional treatments.
Mm. Senator Eaton on this issue?
Yeah, I had a question. I don't know if Senator Dibble can answer it, but I'm wondering if there's any other medications that we allow the public to petition for them to be used to treat different conditions. I was not aware of that process, and this seems kind of unusual.
Madam Chair, I'm not aware of any other either, but this is a unique substance, that's subjected to a fairly tight regimen. I mean, of course, there is a process by which the formularies are amended, and there's a process by which kind of standards of care are established under various boards and bodies that are open to the public for public discussion.
Okay, why don't you continue then in section 4?
And I'll add also that the addition of various substances have been added to formularies by statutory guidance, and I've seen that happen in front of the legislature before too. So that's a form of petitioning various forms of treatment and pharmaceuticals. Line 5.8, paragraph 2. Making sure that the commissioner is establishing the content of the various registration and applications, the forms and whatnot, to capture the kinds of information and in the ways that it needs to be captured. This is particularly important when you think that a lot of this is going to be driven by technology and interoperability, so that there's good communication going on between various stakeholders. Item number 3 on line 5.10, the commissioner can establish a numerically driven scoring system to compare the applicants who are proposing to open alternative treatment centers, including a way to analyze or a means of analyzing and weighting location, accessibility, making sure that those who are going to be the owners and operators of these facilities have measures of character, veracity, background, relevant experience, taking a look at the business plan that they propose, including their ability to supply the substance, make sure that patrons are safe and secure, making sure the community is safe and secure, making sure that there are strong procedures to prevent diversion, make sure that nothing is getting out of controlled hands, and also plans to make it available to low-income folks. Assist strong system for the application and renewal of the registry identification cards, which we had a brief conversation a few minutes ago. Standards in conversation with law enforcement for cannabis organizations is the umbrella term for both the testing facilities as well as the alternative treatment centers, to prevent diversion and theft. And those characteristics would include a method for receiving the applications and renewals of registration certificates. So registration certificates are the authorizing documents that allow the alternative treatment centers and the testing centers to operate, oversight, record keeping, and strong security requirements for locations, including security alarms, access controls, perimeter intrusion detection, personnel identification systems, 24-hour surveillance systems, and making sure that those are very transparent and accessible to the commissioner and law enforcement. Safety requirements, I think.
Just a minute, Senator Dibble. I think we have some students who are leaving us. Where are you from, you guys?
We're the Pages.
Page program.
Oh, the Page program. Oh, great. Good. From the house? Yeah, from the house. Welcome to the Senate. Is that the high school? Oh, okay.
We have on line 5.31, Madam Chair, we have a more general statement around safety requirements. I think that's just a catch-all, giving the commissioner broad authority to take a look at and write rules around safety issues. And then around the packaging and labeling of the cannabis, compliance with poison prevention, making sure that there's child resistance, but also, of course, making sure that seniors can get into these packages if need be.
Senator Scalzi.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. I have a question related to local governments, because in Section 9, we've given local governments
finds that cell phone soon.
Sorry, Madam Chair.
Senator, sorry, Senator Scalzi.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. In Section 9, we're allowing local governments to apply zoning regulations, but then on line 512, we're allowing the commissioner to adopt rules related to the suitability of the proposed location and its accessibility for patients. So I'm just kind of concerned who trumps if law enforcement decides because of public safety it should be in one spot, and actually if the commissioner decides that that's not suitable or accessible, then who trumps? Is it law enforcement or is it the commissioner?
Senator Dibble.
Good question, and I would venture a guess that I don't think the commissioner and law enforcement would be, first of all, in conflict, because of course rule writing is a is an open collaborative process, you know, subject to stakeholder input and public hearings and the like, and I think we're fairly consistent throughout the bill that we're making sure that the commissioner and whomever else is working closely with law enforcement on establishing any regulations, any regimen that there is. That being said, the goal, of course, of Section 9 is to make sure that that cities and local land use mm-hmm. authorities can cite, you know, can have authority over citing these facilities within reason. Of course, they can't exclude them entirely, but you know they can say you're going over here or you're not. You know, and we also have distance standards, of course, which is in another part of the bill from sensitive uses. But as a general rule, I think unless specifically preempted, local land use prevails. I think there needs to be a specific state preemption from local land use regs. The suitability of location, of course the commissioner can determine for him or herself what that means exactly, but that has to do, of course, with proximity and compatible land uses, et cetera, et cetera. I think that's very consistent with how zoning works anyways.
I think that Ms. Stengel, Senate Counsel, can kind of clarify that section.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Scalzi. The language on 5.12 of the bill talks about the suitability of proposed location, but that's not necessarily looking at any of the zoning issues or the local authority. If you look back on lines 5, 10, and 11, we're talking here about scoring competing treatment center locations. So if there is two or three places that the commissioner, that the rules talk about, the commissioner will look at these competing places, and one of the things that they look at is the proposed location. So, for example, if it's in a small city that's difficult to access for many people in the county versus somewhere that's more central, the more central location may get a higher scoring as their application, and they're looking at which one to grant. So it's not necessarily about looking at an individual city and telling them you have to zone to allow them here or there. So I think there's similar but different issues.
Okay. Senator Dipple.
And I agree with Ms. Stengel, but I'll also say, though, that some of those issues that would be taken into consideration under zoning, sensitive uses nearby or compatible uses, et cetera, can be included in the analysis that the commissioner does.
Okay, proceed.
So the packaging requirements, requirements for safe production and testing of cannabis, and then on paragraph 6, we repeat ourselves a little bit. Requirements for testing and labeling of cannabis, including an indication of potency of these THC and CBD are two of the major compounds within cannabis that that have some of the therapeutic effects, and the weight of the cannabis product intended for oral consumption. So the ratio as it relates to the weight. So giving consumers some information about what they're getting putting them in a much, much better set of circumstances than if they're, of course, going out on the street. Establishing procedures and criteria for suspending and revoking registration certificates and registry identification cards. So those, of course, can be revoked for violations or, of course, if conditions and circumstances of a particular patient change. And establishing this, again, gets a little bit to some of what Senator Hall was asking about earlier. Also relating to the location issues, restrictions relating to signage, marketing, display, and advertising. Mm-hmm. So, I think some folks feel strongly that they don't want, neon signs flashing with arrows and that sort of thing. Some of the excesses that we've seen in one particular other state. A process for accepting and investigating complaints, conducting criminal background checks on the officers and board members. I'll just add parenthetically, there is a requirement that background checks be conducted on employees of the alternative treatment centers and the testing facilities. And then finally, number 11, inventory tracking system. Other states that have been successful track cannabis from the time it's planted to the time it's sold and consumed. And so there's very, very tight tracking of every single plant and everything so that there's no doubt what exists. And it's all tracked through barcoding or some other system like that. And the commissioner is asked to establish those rules and that regimen.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Dibble, as it relates to administrative rules and authority, as you probably know, there's a bill that's moving through the legislature right now that greatly expands the authority for the Board of Pharmacy to make their own rules and restrict particular substances on the basis that they're either substantially similar to Schedule I substance. I think it even grants cease and desist authority to the Board of Pharmacy.
Mm-hmm.
In what way does this particular bill, is this bill notwithstanding? And if so, where's the language in this bill to do that? And if not, are we potentially, by way of this other vehicle, granting the Board of Pharmacy the administrative capability to prevent doing this in the first place?
Hmm. Madam Chair.
Senator Dibble.
Senator Peterson, I did not know about this bill.
It's known as the Synthetic Drugs Bill.
Oh, interesting. Okay, I do know about this bill. That issue. I would defer to counsel as to whether or not that would present an issue.
Do you know?
Madam Chair, Senator Peterson, Senator Dibble, and members, I do not know the answer to that. That would be something we'd have to look at more closely to give you an answer.
This bill is going from here to the Judiciary Committee, so I think, and then it'll go from there, I think, to Finance. So it still has a route to go to figure out some of these questions. It didn't come up in Health Committee, though.
Madam Chair, no, it did not. I think it's a good issue to highlight, and I'd like to address it. I would not want that bill to give the Board of Pharmacy the ability to preempt.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
It's accomplished in this bill.
Sam Peterson.
All right.
It's possible that because it's not the law and we haven't granted this sweeping authority to the Board of Pharmacy that, in fact, we haven't addressed the issue because we're looking at what the statute is and how we can change it. But it does get into another problem with the bill or a problem with the way that we're going about it, which is the fact that it seems sort of rather intentionally are leaving marijuana as a Schedule I substance in the statute, when in fact, I mean, by the very definition of what the Schedule I drug is, marijuana doesn't qualify. It's the standard, I believe, is highly addictive and no acceptable medical use in the United States, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
That's clearly not true. We have multiple states that are using it as a form of medicine, and yet, we're proceeding forward here and leaving a remnant of statute in place that is entirely incompatible with the approach we have here. I have an amendment on that issue I'm actually not going to move the amendment because I have a feeling of what the outcome of that is going to be. But nonetheless, for the committee and for just everybody who cares about this issue, we ought to take a look at the scheduling of this drug in general, and we should come back and make that change because there is no interpretation of the definition of Schedule One that marijuana meets. That in conjunction with the scheduling, the issue with this new authority or proposed authority to the Board of Pharmacy, I think, presents some incompatibilities that ought to be dealt with. As an advocate for this bill, obviously as a co-author, those are things that we ought to sort out. So,
Senator Dibble, was that discussed in Health Committee, the Schedule One issue?
Madam Chair, the issue was certainly raised. It was never discussed. There was never any discussion about eliminating marijuana, cannabis, as a Schedule One drug. It was raised as a barrier, as an issue. Some agree strenuously with the identification of marijuana, cannabis, as a Schedule One substance, and others disagree with equal conviction. I'm sympathetic to Senator Peterson's arguments. I think the trouble is, of course, eliminating it as a Schedule One substance in state statutes doesn't change anything federally. And so we're still kind of caught on the horns of that dilemma. It also starts us down this path of having a conversation about use of marijuana for other reasons. I think that's a somewhat distracting and much more involved conversation, and that is not at all what's proposed or contemplated in what we're trying to accomplish today. So I haven't entertained that idea or that conversation. Frankly, it's the reason why we have to do this in this form and fashion, to create a fairly tight set of regulations and a fairly very, very tight set of circumstances, because for all kinds of socio-political and other reasons, marijuana landed on the Schedule One list, and unwinding that is going to be a very, very long national debate.
Senator Peterson.
And thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Dibble. And like I said before, I wholeheartedly support this bill, and I plan to vote for it. Fundamentally, this bill grants more authority for doctors and patients to make healthcare decisions that best fit their needs, and that's what this is all about. I simply bring it up as a matter that ought to be discussed and ought to be discussed going forward, and particularly I'm concerned about this other Senate file that I believe could potentially pose a problem, and so hopefully in the interim you take a look at that.
Senator Eaton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is, why are we creating separate locations for the distribution of this medicine? We have pharmacies. We have a board of pharmacy with most of these rules already in place. And I think it's pretty unusual that we would grow and process our medication and distribute it out of the same building. But besides that, there's a reason we have a board of pharmacy, which is to monitor and track and do inventory and determine how things should be packaged. And all of these rules are addressed in the rules from the Board of Pharmacy. And I just question why, if this is a medicine, we have to do this separately.
Senator Dibble.
Madam Chair, Senator Eaton, we are doing this. We're creating the alternative treatment centers, frankly, to respond to some of the concerns raised by the fact that this continues to be a Schedule One substance, to respond to the concerns, the criticism, the critiques of law enforcement and others around safety, security, diversion. Frankly, these alternative treatment centers rise to a much, much higher standard than the pharmacies do. They're not the same. In terms of security, security of access, security of of who is able to receive this particular substance. It's, you know, a function of a card with an ID on it. I will propose to you that pharmacies are not as successful at preventing diversion of the controlled substances that they have under their control. I think under this proposal, you'll see much, much more success at preventing the diversion of cannabis. We well know that there's a hot market in trade in prescription pharmaceuticals, opioids, and the other. So pharmacies and the Board of Pharmacy has not been successful in the way we would have hoped. I think this will cause us to be much, much more successful and, frankly, to respond to all the criticism and all the critiques that have come in from those who are opposed.
Senator Eaton.
Has the thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Dibble, has anybody discussed this with the Board of Pharmacy or with the Board of Pharmacy, I guess? I'm just wondering if it was even approached. They do deal with Schedule I drugs all the time and narcotics and stuff, and I think they do a pretty good job of keeping them under control. We're overprescribing them, and people are not doing a good job at home in keeping them under control so that kids are getting a hold of them. But I think they really do a good job of controlling narcotics, prescribed narcotics. And since marijuana, I mean, most of us agree, is not a Schedule I drug, I would certainly think they would be capable of managing that.
Senator Dibble.
Madam Chair, thank you, Senator Eaton. I think we just fundamentally disagree on how good a job pharmacies and the control of prescription pharmaceuticals are. I mean, I think we're awash in addiction in this country on what should be prescribed medicine. I'll also just mention to you that one patient can only go to one place to get medical cannabis, contrasted with if you have a prescription for something else, you can pretty much go to any pharmacy you want, and then you see, you know, the kind of pharmacy shopping that goes on and the gross overaccumulation of addictive prescribed drugs. To answer your question about whether or not the Board of Pharmacy has been approached, I don't think so. But Ms. Ozzie also has some perspective to share on this question.
Ms. Ozzie.
Madam Chair, members, the reason that we cannot distribute medical marijuana or cannabis through a pharmacy system is because of federal law, quite frankly. The federal government licensed pharmacists, and if a pharmacist were to distribute a controlled one substance via the pharmacy, they would lose their registration to distribute any controlled substances from the federal government. That requires us to set up the system that resembles the pharmacy system and model after it.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I think Senator Dibble handled it well, but just to take the assertion a little bit more head on, 60% of all overdose deaths in this country come as a result of prescription drugs. To Senator Dibble's point, I think it is a subject of much debate as to whether or not pharmacies have been successful in keeping the public, quote unquote, safe from controlled substances. That's all, Madam Chair.
Senator Eaton.
Thank you. I would like to point out that doctors and APRNs prescribe, not pharmacies. Pharmacies just distribute. But on the other hand, I don't know if you're familiar with Keith Straub, but from Normal and his quote from 1979, that medical marijuana is said we're trying to get marijuana reclassified medically. If we do that, we'll do in at least 20 states this year for chemotherapy patients. We'll be using the issue as a red herring to give marijuana a good name. That's our way of getting to them indirectly, like the paraphernalia laws are on their way at getting to us.
Madam Chair.
Senator Dibble.
Madam Chair, I got my start in politics and organizing and trying to solve problems that are facing people in the HIV/AIDS movement. I've been working on this issue since the mid-'80s. The second bill I introduced in my legislative career was to allow compassionate access to medical marijuana. If Senator Eaton is suggesting that I have an alternative motive, I would take offense to that characterization. I am proposing what's in this bill and this bill alone, and I have not at all participated or had conversation with anyone from Normal, and that is not what's in front of you today to be considered, and that is not what I'm pursuing. I would hope that we would keep our conversation to the confines of what I'm proposing and not question the veracity of what I'm proposing to do here on behalf of people who are suffering.
Okay, I think we're going to move now to taking some testimony. And I know that, Ms. Ozzie, did you have any additional comments you wanted to make?
I do not, thank you.
Okay. Then we have Aggie Lighthizer, Assistant Commissioner. Ms. Lighthizer. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Aggie Lighthizer. I'm an assistant commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Health. I oversee several divisions, including the Compliance Monitoring Division, that would be very involved in implementing this bill. Thank you for the opportunity to share our perspective and some of our issues. As Commissioner Ellinger said when he testified at the Senate Health and Human Services Committee, we recognize the hope expressed by those who seek access to medical marijuana or to medical cannabis. We also want to see the chemicals within the marijuana plant help make things better for suffering Minnesotans. But in achieving that goal, we need to focus on the medicine part of medical marijuana and not just the marijuana part. We do not believe the bill as currently drafted achieves the goal of compassionate use through a scientifically sound manner. We also believe that the bill raises a number of administrative questions and technical concerns. And to clarify, the concerns I raised today are not all of our concerns, but given the direction from the chair and the scope of the committee, we're limiting our comments today to the issues particularly related to rulemaking and the related topics. We hope we'll have the opportunity to talk about other concerns in other venues. So our questions and concerns include, can there be more clarity on when key deliverables and actions will take place that would help address the implications of the bill? For example, the timeline for this implementation is very ambitious. The Department of Health is directed to start issuing cards by July 1st of 2015. That date assumes that all the associated development work, such as the rulemaking, IT development, hiring, reviewing and scoring the applications, et cetera, will be done in time to begin that process on July 1st. We expect these rules will take some time to promulgate based on the interest that the issue generates. Typically, our rulemaking process takes between 9 and 12 months, but it's not unusual for us to go to 18 months to complete all the required steps, and so we're concerned about the timeline for that. We are directed to set up a numerically scored bidding process for applications. What might we do if there is a tie? What if decisions were challenged? How do we reconcile delays due to litigation with the requirement that we issue cards by a certain date? When will the alternative treatment centers be able to start planting? Does that happen only after the rulemaking is complete, or is it at a different time? When will the registered individuals be able to receive medical cannabis? We assume access would occur after all of the process procedures have been completed and cultivation and manufacture of the products. If that assumption is incorrect, how do we manage the process in the meantime? What is the purpose of the safety compliance facility, and what relationship would they have to the Department of Health? It appears they are intended to provide information about the purity and consistency of the dispensed products. They are also expected to provide scientific and medical research findings related to medical cannabis. Are they therefore doing independent research? And would those research findings or reports be subject to review by the department? And does the facility have a role in determining the potency of the product? And is that an option the patient has, or is that something that we would need to be requiring that all products are tested prior to being distributed? What standards apply to the care provided by the designated caregivers? What authority does the department have over their qualifications and performance? What about complaints about their qualifications or conduct? If they are guilty of diversion or other misconduct, what happens to the patients under his or her care? The department is directed to keep information about registered patients. Some of the needs that add potential developmental complexity for implementation and therefore make us concerned about the timeline include the development of a web-based verification system that's accessible to law enforcement. The requirements of the patient registration card, including a photograph and the use of the 20-digit randomized number and the process of establishing that, the electronic transmission of criminal history checks, establishment of a cannabis inventory tracking system that will take time and additional resources. We've been talking with other states and have learned from Colorado that they spent $1.2 million on their cannabis inventory tracking solution. And we'll be continuing to look at other cost assumptions, including the changes from today's amendment. And finally, there are a few areas in the bill that we do not believe adequately prevent diversion of cannabis as required by the Federal Department of Justice. This is based on an August 2013 Department of Justice memo to the U.S. attorneys about enforcement priorities under the Federal Controlled Substances Act. States need to prevent diversion of cannabis and marijuana into the hands of persons not authorized. Keeping it out of these hands help further our public health goals to avoid things such as drug driving and access to THC by persons who might be especially harmed. We have three particular concerns in this area. What are the requirements for how cannabis is disposed of, by whom and when? This would be needed for either unused cannabis seeds or any unused cannabis. What if the patient and provider disagree whether the patient has a debilitating medical condition? Does the patient have a right to appeal, and if so, what process would we use? Current language allows the patient 10 days to notify MDH if they cease to have a debilitating condition and 15 days if the practitioner determines that. These longer time periods risk diversion to those who should not have access. Given these unresolved questions, as well as the need to protect public confidence in the safety and effectiveness of approved medicines, our view is that legalizing medical cannabis for medical use should be done only with caution and deliberation. We believe there is value in continuing to work with both the medical and research community to examine the potential benefits of medical marijuana. Like the medical marijuana advocates, we want to find new and effective treatment options for those who are sick and in pain. That goal is advanced, not delayed, by evaluating marijuana or cannabis with the same scientific rigor that is applied to other potential medicines. Thank you.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. These are all excellent points and questions, some, I think, more than others. And, of course, a number of these can easily be responded to by saying that the commissioner has it within his authority to answer those questions for himself through the pretty broad rulemaking authority we've given him. I spoke with the commissioner a couple of hearings ago and said my door is wide open. He said, I'll be calling you and we'll talk some more because I want to have a productive conversation. My phone has yet to ring. I'm hearing these issues for the first time sitting here today. So it's interesting that they choose this venue and opportunity to raise, some issues that could have been dealt with in the language that's in front of us. I think they do need to be dealt with because
Senator
they're good Dibble, issues.
You had two hearings in the Health and Human Services Committee. I assume they were like two-hour hearings.
Madam Chair, that is correct.
And Ms. Lighthizer, why were these issues not brought up at the Health and Human Services Committee so that Senator Dibble would have time to incorporate them into his amendment, at least for today?
Madam Chair, I think some of the issues were raised, and we've noticed that some of the concerns that we've had have been addressed by some of the changes that have occurred so far. As we continue to evaluate and we continue to do the assessment of the implementation procedures, we've identified additional issues. We have just been able to review the current version that just was available to us very shortly, so we've been continuing to develop these.
Well, I would hope that you would give a copy of your testimony to Senator Dibble and the staff so that they can, I agree that during the rulemaking process you should be able to resolve some of those issues. Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And it's hard to address, the 30 questions or whatever it is that you posed in succession. And in listening to them and just sort of taking a mental note, it seemed to me that at least – a large majority of those questions are easily answered and don't rise to anywhere near the level of complexity of the questions that your department deals with on a day-to-day basis. Some of the questions, frankly, you know the answer to. For example, the reason why there isn't more scientific research or research that reaches your satisfaction is because we have laws in place and, for example, FDA approval. that prevent that from happening? So you know the answer to that question, but I think the I think you were quoted as saying, like the patients and their families, we would like to find new and innovative treatment options. But the difference is, they have a treatment option. They've sort of found that. And so the only question that really matters to me is, what are you going to do to provide that to them today and provide that relief to them today? In absent sort of federal action, I don't see what you are going to do if we don't move in this direction.
Ms. Lighthouser.
Madam Chair and Senator Peterson, we did have an alternative proposal that we had recommended to be considered that was discussed in the Health and Human Services Committee around a study that we would do in conjunction with the Mayo Clinic to evaluate and do a controlled study that would add to the scientific background and research on medical marijuana, and that was not moved forward.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and that's really, and again, as you know that is going to take years to do, and in the meantime, despite the fact that we have an option that's available today that can provide relief, those families are going to have to wait. So although you say like the patients and their families, you're really not like them at all, in the sense that it's easy for us to pontificate about what needs to be done or what could be done or what could be done over a stretch of years. While they wait for us to take action on something that is relatively harmless, in particular as it relates to the substances that deal with the young children. I have yet to hear a compelling reason as to why we can't move forward on that, other than the fact that government itself has created a whole bunch of constructs that prevent us from doing that which we can remedy with this vehicle. So that's all I have to say, Madam Chair.
Any other comments? Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think Senator Dibble, and we're joining 20 other states, I believe, perhaps, if this bill should go forward. I would assume that maybe you can give me some insight on, is there a particular state that you've modeled this legislation after? And if so, how long has their policy been in place? We're not reinventing the wheel here. And I also assume that if there's 20 states, we're on the more prescriptive or tightly legislative state. So maybe give a little history of how you put this bill together in that regard.
Senator Dipple.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Dahl. That's an excellent question, and actually it was a point that I was going to raise in response to the department's testimony. There are a couple of other states, and Ms. Ozzie can help us a little bit too, because she was instrumental in crafting the proposal that's in front of us. And we actually have a handout that kind of shows a compare and contrast, which we can make available if you're interested or if the committee is interested, that shows at least one other successful state, New Mexico, Arizona is another one, and how our state even does better in being more prescriptive and creating more access and more control and more ways to address diversion and that sort of thing. See, a little note here, New Mexico's been around since 2004 with their program, Arizona since 2008. And so there's a lot of data that shows whether or not folks are getting what they need, and folks who have no business getting access to medical cannabis, whether or not we're successful with that. We have a study that we handed out at the last hearing that shows that in those states there's no additional and in some cases less use of marijuana by teenagers, which has been articulated as a real key concern by law enforcement and other opponents, and that just does not bear out in the research. And I think Ms. Ozzie can help us a little bit here if you have a response.
Sure. There are
Ms. Ozzie.
Madam Chair, members, there are 21 states now who, plus the District of Columbia, actually, who permit the medical use of marijuana in citizens. California was the first. It was enacted way back in 1996, and, of course, their program is fraught with problems from our perspective. This language has been modeled after the medical marijuana laws adopted in some of the more conservative states like Arizona and New Mexico that have been enacted just in the last decade and have very solid programs that control access well.
Thank you. We have another person who wanted to testify. That's Autumn Leva. Is Autumn here?
Oh, and Madam Chair, while Ms. Leva is coming forward, I did want to mention that if the committee is interested, we have a gentleman here who was involved in establishing some of the rule. He was involved in the rule writing and a lot of the research as well. If you're interested, just let me know he's here.
Okay, why don't you bring him forward? While you come forward, Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Under the rulemaking, it talks about that we've added some language here in compliance with the United States Poison Prevention Packing Act, and then we say requirements for safe production and testing of cannabis. Is the Commissioner of Health being asked to set up a testing lab in the state of Minnesota?
Senator Dibble.
Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, no. We have, as a matter of fact, the gentleman, Mr. Stubbs. Chris Stubbs actually can help respond to that. We do allow the commissioner to authorize testing facilities, and so that would be carried out by contract with the alternative treatment centers. We would have independent or private organizations conduct the testing. So the commissioner himself or herself or the agency wouldn't conduct the testing, but would authorize and have control over what the testing would look like.
And would that be in state, or it could be like a facility in Arizona or New Mexico or somewhere else?
No, Madam Chair, it would have to be here in state. In state. So again, okay. Because of the federal rules, we can't transport this stuff back and forth.
So, Madam
Senator
Chair,
Anderson.
Senator Dibble, is there a guideline for what the testing lab will look like?
Senator Dibble.
Madam Chair, again, that would be the authority of the commissioner to establish all of those features. I can point to the language. In any place where it says a cannabis organization, so all of the various procedures, protocols, et cetera, for what we call a cannabis organization, that's a way of describing both the testing centers as well as the alternative treatment centers. Alternative treatment center is just another word for dispensary.
Dispensary, okay.
So if you look at, that a cannabis organization is either an alternative treatment center or one of the testing facilities, safety compliance facility,
safety
we call it.
Okay.
So safety compliance facility is described on line 3.21 to 3.27. Provide consumer protection services to the public by means of laboratory sampling and testing for potency and contaminants, information and training services, safe, efficient packaging, labeling and distribution, security and inventory accountability procedures, scientific and medical research findings.
It's Mr. Stubbs.
Yes, Madam
correct?
Chair.
Okay, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. I have been involved with the medical cannabis community since approximately 2001. I studied it in a variety of different settings. My most recent experience is in the health and safety and potency testing of cannabis by a third-party laboratory. This is a central tenet to this program. As I stand here today, how many of you have seen the pediatric epilepsy stories on CNN, for example? The reason that therapy is even being talked about was because of our ability in the laboratory to discern the over 60 active compounds in the plant and tell, for example, here we talk about the ratio of THC to CBD. Cannabidiol, CBD, is the active ingredient that supposedly is helping these pediatric patients with epilepsy. And if it weren't for our ability to discern these various compounds, we would not be able to profile that and actually steer these patients towards products that work for them. So I think that moving forward, it becomes very important to set ourselves apart from, I guess, the cloudiness of what we call, what you alluded to earlier, the red herring situation. Medical cannabis is a real efficacious treatment for a wide variety of disease states. And the reason that is so is because our own bodies have a receptor network called the endocannabinoid system that interacts with these phytocannabinoids in the plant. Our brain produces two principal endocannabinoids, and they interact with our central nervous system via the cannabinoid 1 receptor and our immune system via the cannabinoid 2 receptor. So one of the questions we often get asked is, how can this substance help with so many different disease states? And it's because of this inherent biology that we all have. You know, to give you a couple other interesting insights, for example, the plant itself does not produce delta-9 THC. It produces cannabinoids in an acidic form, which upon heating form delta-9 THC and have that psychoactive effect. So whether or not a patient's going to be able to come in and actually get what they need becomes a big question. And one of the reasons we've been so effective in other states is because when we have access to a safety compliance facility, as we call it in this law, we can actually take a very medically and scientifically efficacious approach to this so that we can study it and we can package it and label it properly and all be on the same page. So I think that
Mr. Stubbs, as long as you paused, I was curious about this. If it requires heat to activate, you know, kind of key pain-relieving elements, how does it work for how does it work if it's in a liquid or a pill form then, and how would it work with children who might not be in a position to smoke it?
Sure, Madam Chair. The wide range of products that one sees comes from a variety of different standpoints, okay? So the raw flower is your starting point. And that raw flower can be characterized in a number of different ways. The two basic ones are high THC and low THC, what we call marijuana and what we call hemp. The genetics of these plants have been bred specifically for that high THC acid, the native form of THC. They've been bred to have a psychoactive effect and to be smelly. Whereas hemp is grown for fiber. Well, it's not until we start looking at all the minor cannabinoids in this plant that you start to see these other uses. So, for example, if I extract the flower itself, we've automatically got a resinous base to formulate other products. The Charlotte's Web story, which is the pediatric epilepsy banner story that we've been hearing a lot about, I helped formulate that product specifically and tested in the lab to make sure that they knew exactly how many milligrams per milliliter were in it. And it was a really simple formulation in a sense. You know, we knew that these children were having a very difficult time even swallowing in most cases. So the vehicle had to be something like honey or olive oil. And those were the two vehicles that we actually pursued. And now we've got a handful of kids that have been seizure-free for a couple of years. Once you take this base extract, you can formulate it into a number of different carriers, whether it be topical or edible. And all of those different products can have varying ratios of not only the two principal cannabinoids that we talk about here, but the other 60-some-odd known variants as well as the terpenoids, which is another class of active molecules in many spices and other medical plants around that we use around the world. So when taken out of flower form, the resin can be used in a whole number of different ways, including but not limited to infusions that these children, for example, take. Their doses are very, very, very much different than the sustained dose that a cancer patient would take. We're talking about orders of magnitude different. So what the potency and health and safety testing side brings to the table is really the ability to start the dialogue with the scientific and medical community so that we can actually talk in milligrams per kilogram and how these treatments are working. And then we can start to actually study it. You know, in the past, it's been very difficult for any of these numbers to come forward and, you know, have the same ground to stand on. And even in Colorado, for example, where a lot of my experience lies, safety compliance facilities were not mandated. They were not licensed until very recently. And the testing and labeling wasn't enforced, or I should say required. So it was the burden was on us to prove that this all exists for a reason. And I would think that we're getting a much better head start here making that a requirement. And I would hope that moving forward, that would be a central tenet of the legislation. I yield to questions.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Stubbs? Is there anyone else in the audience that would like to testify on preferably issues before the committee? Okay. Yes, sir.
Madam Chairman, my name is Aníbal Fernández. I used to be a police officer. I'm aware of my emblema may cause some of you guys feeling like onions in your mouth, but marijuana has been helping me to deal with the stress, post-traumatic stress syndrome over my career as a police officer in North Dakota. I just want to share that with all of you guys.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hernandez. All right. Any other questions from members of the committee? Are we ready for a motion? Senator Peterson, you want the honor?
Madam Chair, I'd like to move Senate File 1641